This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. My name is Patrick Beja, and today we're going to be talking about something a little bit different. Usually, what we do is that, especially on these end-of-month episodes, we talk to different people from different parts of the world and get their opinions and feelings on what's been happening in the past month or so. And we also have specials where we talk about one specific thing. In the past couple of months, we've been talking a lot about the same topics, a lot about, you know, COVID and the presidential election in the US and also the Brexit and things like that. And I felt like I wanted to get away from that a little bit. And if I went to the usual people, it would have been that again. So I thought, no, let's get something else, something different, different people. Turns out it's one person who's going to be talking about something that I'm not sure we have all heard about in detail. Let's introduce her now. Ach, how is it going?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's really nice that you want to get the perspective all around the world and talking a bit other things than elections and COVID should be interesting, I guess. So, yeah. So I'm from Armenia. Basically, my day job is just being technical recruiter and hiring for roles in game development. And basically, this is how I know you. And and recently, the situation in Armenia is a bit different, and everybody is not only their profession, but also a bit more than just their profession, considering the war situation and post-war situation. So that's basically how it's going right now.
So I didn't say it explicitly, but we're going to be talking about the war in Armenia. And so if you were hoping for a lighter subject, I guess you're out of luck because no one wants to talk about happy things. Maybe go watch Ted Lasso. It's a wonderful show. It's amazing. But I feel like the war in Armenia is so... it's such a great example of things that we should be talking about more on this show and in general, because we feel like it's the end of the world here. When I say here, I mean like in Europe, in the US, every time something bad happens. And there are places where actually bad things are happening all the time, and we're not really even aware of it. Like, maybe it's because of COVID and the American election and stuff like that, but the war in Armenia, it's not like it hasn't been reported on. It's definitely been reported on in Europe, at least. But we were so focused on other things that the extent of my knowledge of this conflict, and I apologize, Ach, I'm going to be asking a lot of very dumb questions, which is my specialty on this show.
I mean, curiosity counts.
The extent of my knowledge on the topic is apparently Armenia and Azerbaijan have been in a war for the past few weeks, and now it's been resolved, very much to the deficit of Armenia through the influence of Turkey and Russia. And I don't know what the war is about. I don't know how bad it was. I don't know how involved the population, the civilian population was. Like, I am embarrassingly uninformed about all of this. So can you please make me less dumb, I guess, is the request.
Okay, I will try. Given my profession is in journalism at all, and I'm just going to share my personal experience. That's what we're looking for. I will try to be a bit less dumb in the conflict, given I'm in the situation. So basically what happened started long ago, but I'm not going to dive into the history part of it. Just the recent escalations could involve 4 years ago when of something called four-day war happened between, again, Azerbaijan and Artsakh with support of Armenia inside of the Artsakh, of course.
Azerbaijan and what?
Artsakh, yeah, I was going to elaborate. Okay. The territories are disputed, and while the international community calls it Nagorno-Karabakh, and so does Azerbaijan, most of the people in Armenia now call it Artsakh because it's non-recognized country, republic. But yeah, I mean, maybe I chose the wrong wording, and Nagorno-Karabakh will be more, you know.
I don't think I would have known either, but just to be clear, it's a territory on the border between Armenia and Azerbaijan, right?
Yes, and basically that's a disputed area. Basically, officially, UN side, it's Azerbaijani territory, but factually, de facto, it was ruled by Armenians since the Soviet Union is no more in the area. Basically, it was just an independent area governed on its own. I mean, you have a person that's the president of the republic, but you know, as long as nobody knows the republic and nobody recognizes the republic, is just a self-recognized one. Okay. So this is basically the situation. I mean, you can already get the feeling how mixed up everything is. That's because the territory has been historically lived by both Armenians and Azeri people, and there were some periods where it was very peaceful. People were very friendly with each other, but things changed with the recent escalation 30 years ago when the war was between Azerbaijan and Armenia after the Soviet Union crashed. And recently, after the 4 days war that happened four years ago, the very recent escalation happened this year, September 27. I mean, right when everybody was really busy with elections, with COVID happening around, all the media around the world was announcing that the clashes...
Sorry, just a second. When you say everyone was busy with the election, which election are you referring to?
A lot of things were happening around the world. U.S. elections were being prepared, and everybody knew that it's going to be a big one. And
yeah, that's why I'm asking, because it's not obvious to me, and I guess to some of the listeners, that in Armenia you would be following the U.S. election. I guess it just confirms everyone in the world has been following it. But you're also saying that in Armenia, it was a significant topic of conversation in September before the war started.
That's not what I meant. I mean, okay. While the world was busy.
World was busy. Okay, you didn't care about the U.S. election.
Well, we did, but not not to extent to have it bold enough in the community to have more attention to that than to the situation happening in the, locally, because COVID was pretty harsh in Armenia. A lot of cases and second wave. Yeah, second wave was there. So basically, September 27 is the date that international media reported that war erupted again, but basically it's known fact that this is where you're gonna be You want me to tell how neutral I want to be. I mean, basically, it is just claimed that both sides are blaming each other for starting the war again. But to me, it doesn't make sense that Armenia will restart the war because it wasn't very much in our benefit. Mm-hmm. So basically, yeah, 44 days and real war. For me personally, it felt like a bit of unrealistic because 21st century, you don't expect to have the war, like really the war, and listening how people are killed, both civilians and both military people on both sides. I mean, war isn't something very, very beautiful. And this one was pretty much a shocking one for both sides, I guess.
So how did it start then? Do you think the Azerbaijan forces tried to enter Artsakh?
I think so. Because
just to be clear again, sorry, for the people who aren't listening, and I'm you know watching on a map as we're discussing, so it's not like I actually know what I'm talking about, but the territory is actually inside Azerbaijan land, and it's like an island inside Azerbaijan land, but it is supposedly independent and mostly comprised of an Armenian population, correct?
Yes.
Right.
Yep. Yep. Very much.
And so the Azerbaijan forces tried to enter the
parts of the territory of Nagorno-Karabakh that were ruled by Armenians and tried to rule more land, I'd say. So and basically, as you mentioned, the war was 44 days and recently on November 10th, the ceasefire was agreed upon. I mean, it was fourth ceasefire de facto and the only one that still keeps. Before that, there were another agreements that we are stopping, but nothing was happening. I mean, people were agreeing to stop and 10 minutes later. After that, both sides were claiming that others restarted the fire. So
before we get to the end, supposedly the end of the conflict, when it started, can you give me an image or an impression of the reaction of people in Armenia? Was it surprise? Was it like how did people react in the beginning of the war?
Oh, vividly for me, I do remember how it started. I mean, you just wake up in the morning and you read another announcement that some clashes are happening on the border because this used to be like the typical situation. You just know some clashes are happening all the time, but then there is a difference between clashes and war. And like closer to the midday, that was just Sunday, and closer to the midday, you just feel that this is way more than just clashes because the amount of clashes and everything was already prognosing that this is not just another clashes and this is going to be big. So personally, for me, it was very much surprise. I mean, you are planning on your Sunday on doing fun stuff, and then you just realize that, oh my God, closer to the evening, your friend is called back to the army just because they need more people. I mean, this was pretty much the situation. Everybody was a bit surprised. I mean, not very surprised. Surprise, because basically this is a situation. Everybody knows that we were in pre-war situation, and every minute war could be restarted. But the date and when and how it happened was a surprise. And my guess would be that wasn't just the population, but also some of the political elite wasn't very prepared to that. And, you know, I don't know if you were following the news in Armenia, but we recently had some major political change since it was a very peaceful revolution in Armenia 2 years ago. And we were just trying to see the fruits of this revolution. And war was one of the most discussed topics.
You can tell us a bit more about that as well, because, of course, when we're hearing about the war and the resolution, which is in which is to the disadvantage of Armenia. We start hearing about the change in government and the promises that were made a couple of years ago. But can you tell us a little bit more about that so that we get some context? What happened 2 years ago?
So basically for dozens of years, I mean, like 20 plus years, Armenia didn't have a truly elected legitimate government. I was myself watching the elections. It was just whatever is happening around, that wasn't the election. And basically the revolution was the way to change the government and choose someone that was truly chosen by the population. I mean, people were finally again back involved in a political situation, and they weren't just, okay, they're going to do whatever they want to do, whatever happens, but people were actually looking back into what is happening, how the money, like finances, are governed and stuff like that. And but in the like background, everybody knew that this isn't something that Russia is very very like sympathetic with, because changing and going towards more democratic structure of the population and like overall country wouldn't be something that Russia is very, happy with, yeah. And basically everybody was afraid that this is going to happen, because similar cases happened with Ukraine, with Georgia, and you got the idea, I guess. I mean,
yeah, so
that was the fear.
The thing which has been happening recently, for those who might not be aware, is that for various reasons, Russia has been intervening in the affairs of other countries, especially when they seem to be inching towards the West and the European Union. And that is always a concern, and especially in Finland, where I live, which is on the border of Russia, but part of the EU. So it's a little bit more complicated for Russia to butt in. But so it's always a concern, something we keep an eye on. But so what you're saying, what you're suspecting, is that it is not impossible that Russia might have, elbowed Azerbaijan a little bit, and said, "Hey, why don't you do that?" And then
No. That wasn't where I was going. I was rather going towards part of the security from that country was lost. I mean, this is pretty much a region, post-Soviet region, where you still feel the influence and Russia being one of the biggest financial and economical aspects in the area. And the previous government was very personally connected with the elite in Russia, I'd say so. I mean, this is as far as I can judge. I mean, I'm not into the topic, but whatever. So basically what I'm saying is changing and moving towards democracy was costing us a bit of losing the support there, and having less security feeling from that area. Though Armenia is officially involved in a military alliance with Russia, and the countries have been very friendly historically, and with considering the Soviet history. That's not what I was saying. I was rather saying that a part of the security was lost with that.
Okay. So the presence of Russia in the region was a stabilizing force. Mm-hmm. And so with the changes, the political changes in Armenia, that kind of watchful Russia kind of lost a little bit of its influence there, which might have opened the door for Azerbaijan to become a little bit more brazing and forward.
But a bigger destabilizing was like destabilizing aspect was Turkey this time. I mean, right. It has been a while since I personally have heard about Turkey being involved in anything connected with Armenia, and this is happening again. I mean, given the history between Armenia and Turkey, I mean, Armenia is basically now having just a diplomatic, healthy relationship just with two of our neighbors, that will be Georgia and Iran. And basically from the other side, Turkey and Azerbaijan, we just have no diplomatic relations whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And Turkey is getting back to the region through this Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. This was a huge bummer for everybody in Armenia and on both personal level and more political thinking of way.
Okay, so let's take a little bit of a chronological view. So the conflict starts at the end of September. The war mm-hmm. really starts at the end of September, and it lasts for about 6 weeks, was it? Something like that?
44 days.
Can you tell us, like, summarize? I know it's probably not easy, but the evolution of things over those 44 days. I'm sure it's the kind of thing that goes really quickly when you look back, but feels like forever when you're living through it.
Exactly. I mean, when I was in the situation, it felt like a lot of things are happening, but then when you have the bigger picture after everything is done. There are two areas that Azerbaijan started to attack upon. That was the north and south mainly. Center was better secured, I guess. That's why they didn't attack on that area. Though the clashes were happening all over the borderline, and Azerbaijan was mainly succeeding to go forwards towards, I mean, if we go geographically in the borderline with Iran, and they were moving in that direction, and they kind of got most of the land under their rules on the southern part, and then moved towards Shushi. And Shushi is Shushi or Shusha, if we go with the Azerbaijani pronunciation, is very, very important, you know, culturally for both nations. I mean, I do see from Armenian perspective why it's important, because it's cultural, because a lot of history goes there. And recently, that was very interesting. Recently, I started to learn why it's also important for Azeri people. And Shusha is also very important, from military perspective, because it's very highly located, and it gives easy way to, you know, to control the area.
This is going to be a very dumb question, and I apologize in advance. Are we still talking about Artsakh, or is it?
Yes.
Okay. So this is focused on that independent republic inside the. Inside the land of.
You could think of it as second city. I mean, there is Stepanakert, which is considered the capital of the unrecognized Republic of Artsakh, and then there is Shushi, which is like kind of cultural center. And Shushi is also, I mean, when we go back to the previous war, Shushi was, we in Armenia have public holiday for the day that Shushi was liberated. Mm. So that you know how important that was for the nation. And then closer to the end of the war, the Shushi was under attack, and clashes were happening in the city. And that's when you get the feeling that the closing is closure is very close. Sorry for the
No, I get it. So can you give me again kind of a picture of how, like, because when we imagine this kind of thing, I imagine everyone, of course, watching the news and getting reports from, you know, journalists and things like that, but also on Twitter all the time and checking maybe even YouTube and stuff like that. Is that the case? Like, you're... Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, my day was basically consisting of 10 hours of scrolling to Twitter, both Armenian media and Azerbaijani media. Basically, Twitter was the only social media available for Azerbaijani people. So that's the only place you could get the voice and the emotions happening on the other side. And basically,
so you would go seek out news from Azerbaijan as well?
Yeah, not many people are doing that, but I figured out this is one of the best ways to get to stay informed, to know about both sides of the story.
So how do you feel about it? Sorry, I'll let you continue, but it's very interesting to me. I'm very curious.
It's sometimes it was very graphic. And personally, I was blocking very graphic content because, it's not a nice thing to see a video of someone getting beheaded and to go then doing your stuff. I mean, it's not really easy. Basically, I was just trying to see the, as a person that believes in peace very much, I mean, I do believe that only towards conversation, towards dialogue, we can close the conflict forever, because now it's just halted and most probably we're re-erupt in a matter of time. I mean, it's just a matter of time. So basically, I was trying to see what other side is thinking, what they feel, what is the part where we can speak again. But in most cases, it was just impossible. I mean, every comment from Armenian person on Azerbaijani accounts was followed just by hundreds of people going with best practices of hate speech and vice versa. I mean, no side was very tolerant towards the other side. And
I guess Twitter is not the place you're going to find the tolerant people, even if they exist. But
yeah
it's not. Sadly, yeah. It's not very surprising. I guess. Yeah.
I think Reddit was very intolerant too, because typically on Reddit you can see people having real conversations, and this wasn't the case. I mean, the conflict goes so deep. I mean, when we compare what we learn at school and what Azeri people learn at school, I mean, those are so very different that when it comes to speak, you just need some ground to know that this is the fact and this is the opinion. But in this conflict, everything is so smashed around. I mean, there is no facts. Everybody is just pushing what fits their political agenda better.
Okay. That is disappointingly unsurprising, I guess. All right, so the 44 days of the conflict, you're just trying to live your life, but like I don't know where you live. Do you live in Yerevan?
Yeah.
So you're just living a normal life with this in the background, because the war is inside, you know, I don't want to say something that's bad, but it's inside Azerbaijani territory, like that independent republic. So I'm guessing, does it, like, how do you even get the troops? You're saying your friends were called upon because they needed military. Was it to strengthen the border in Armenia, or like, does it affect you in Armenia? Because the conflict is outside of the borders of Armenia, right? So
there were some clashes happening on the border for Armenia but basically Armenia is very, basically those people in Artsakh are Armenians, and Armenia as a country is very supportive in all terms that you can imagine. Military.
No, that I understand. But if you want to send troops, like, do you send them by plane over Azerbaijan territory? Like, it's difficult to imagine how Armenia could help militarily.
I see. Okay. Yeah, let me give some perspective. I mean, the part of the Nagorno-Karabakh is kind of connected with Armenia with a very, very thin corridor that now, after the ceasefire has been established, is under peacekeeping forces of Russia. And that is very important corridor. And you can imagine that as a very, the only connecting area between Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh Republic and Armenia. But other than that, all the territory between Nagorno-Karabakh and Armenia were ruled by Armenians as well. So basically, the main way to get was through that corridor, but not only. The territory is very attached to Armenia.
So even though it is technically Azerbaijan, the people there who live there are Armenian, and they're just like, okay, just walk over there. But Azerbaijan doesn't send military forces in that, because it's not a very large area. It's like a handful of kilometers.
Yeah, it's actually 11,000 square kilometers to be precise.
No, sorry. What I mean is the space between the Armenian border and the border of the, I don't want to say the name because I'm butchering it every time, but Artsakh.
Okay, Artsakh, yeah.
Uh-huh. It's like, what, 3 kilometers, 4 kilometers? It's relatively small.
Oh, I don't know, to be honest. It's okay. Kind of 2 hours to get from Armenian border to Stepanakert, I'd guess. I mean, I've been there like a couple of years ago. I wouldn't be able to recall the exact amount of time I spent on the road.
Okay. But so the army, if it needs to go there to defend it, it just goes there, like gets in the truck, the soldiers go in the truck and drive.
I'd guess so. I'm not the best person to answer
okay,
this question.
Okay, no. All right.
I'd guess so.
It's just surprising, you know, that if it is, I get the impression that it's so fuzzy in that region because of the population are one into the other's country that it would be like, but wait, this is Azerbaijani territory, so they can put their military there and prevent anyone from entering, right? They have a border. But I don't, it seems like it's not that clear cut.
No, that's not that clear cut. Mm. In terms of basically, as I said, de facto, it was ruled by Armenians for the last 30 years. And that was the main point of the conflict. I mean, Azerbaijan, like, if I put the conflict just in three simple words, Azerbaijan says that those territories belong to them. And Armenian people there are saying that we want to be independent, as they declared when Soviet Union was. When Armenia or Azerbaijan as a republic announced and voted that they want to get out of the Soviet Union, the same thing was done by Nagorno-Karabakh region, because it was independent, though in the area of Azerbaijani Soviet Republic, but it was independent. And they declared independence after the Soviet Union was not there anymore. But basically, their decision legally won't ever be considered. That's the first war erupted. So basically, if I put it simple, Azerbaijani people are saying this is our territory and it belongs to us. Armenian people there are saying no, we don't. Mm-hmm. So basically, this is the situation.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the neighborhood and the territory doesn't allow us to go with very. If we compare the situation with Kosovo, I don't know if this is the best analogy to go with. But if we compare, in case of Kosovo, a lot of countries are recognizing this as an independent country, and in case of Artsakh, nobody does, because just because of the a lot of non-clear profits, benefits happening around the area. So basically, neighborhood doesn't give it the right to go independent legally, and if the people there want to do that, this is the main. I mean, the conflict is between the sovereignty of Azerbaijani territory and the people of Artsakh wanting to be free. This is the main conflict.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Complicated topic, huh?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm realizing that there's actually Armenian territory around the Artsakh territory we're talking about inside of Azerbaijani territory. So it's super, complicated. All right. So the 44 days, let's get to that. So the 44 days, things are complicated. You try to live your life normally, but with the constant worry and news about what's happening. And some people, like from the Armenian population, even in Yerevan, I'm guessing, being called to the war. How is that going until the
if we go about business side of things, most of the business was trying to operate as they can as proficient as they can during the day and doing some voluntary work during the night or non-business hours. This was the main situation. I mean, everybody was contributing by money, by voluntary work, by just visiting people that are in Armenia. I mean, you could sit in the cafe and see just a family from refugee family from Artsakh sitting next and getting treated by, yeah. I mean, people giving them just like hosting them. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So, just so I try to get a visual picture of it, how is the mm-hmm. capital going during that conflict? Is it everyone like... I'm trying to understand if life was going on as usual with the worry always in everyone's head, or was kind of the war touching the capital and the rest of the country, no, and everyone was like, holy shit, we're at war.
I mean, when you go out to the street, you don't feel war right there, but the mood has changed. Not everybody's having fun anymore. I mean, Friday night, nobody is having any parties around, not because of the COVID, but because of the war. But basically, people were keeping on working and worrying about the situation. I mean, that's a mix of two scenarios you are saying.
Okay, I see. Okay, so we get to after 44 days of truces and truce breaking and no mm-hmm. one knowing exactly what's going to happen, and Turkey and Russia getting involved maybe behind the scenes. My understanding is that the resolution that happened, what was it, a week ago? Was
2 weeks.
2 weeks ago. Okay, sorry. So 2 weeks ago, yeah, that was right in the middle of the American election. So my mind was definitely somewhere else. Was very unfavorable to Armenia, correct? And how?
Yes, it is. I mean, basically, the ceasefire agreement says that we are giving up most of the territory.
But not all of it.
The thing here is both, again, political and psychological, because people will be leaving, I mean, people returning back to Nagorno-Karabakh and Stepanakert, I mean, all the cities that are under Armenian control, they are still refugees going back, but psychologically they won't feel very secure anymore. In sense of, of course, there are peacekeeping forces there, but how secure the things are, how you have the guarantee that nothing will happen again. I mean, mercenaries were involved in the war, and how you know that nothing will be happening and everything is under control of peacekeepers. So this is one of the concerns. But basically, it is very, very, very positive for me that the war stopped, actually, because our friends were fighting, and it is very good that nobody will going to die anymore. I mean, this is the positive part of it.
Yeah, that's actually a question I wanted to ask, and I'm sorry for the grim nature of the question, but do you know how many people died in the war? Because it was a war. It's not like two armies standing on, you know, one side of the border. There was actual conflict. Do you know how many people died?
Oh, well, on our side, we do know, because the Armenian side is announcing names, surnames, and after the ceasefire, I mean, POWs were, I mean, prisoners of war were being changed, I mean, between the nations. Basically, from Armenian side, the estimation, I believe, is around 1,600.
Okay.
And that's just a lot of people.
Mm. Yeah, the population of Armenia is about 3 million people, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes. And for Artsakh, it's around 150,000. So, yeah, the numbers are really high compared to the population.
So, how does the country feel? How did the country feel 2 weeks ago when the ceasefire and the peace was signed?
Oh, I mentioned about the first legitimate leader we have in a while, and now it's... I mean, this is considered kind of a historical loss for Armenia in terms of it has been really important for Armenian people to know that Artsakh is safe. And now a lot of people are considering that there is no other choice than changing the leadership, and which raises a question of, I mean, being a young democracy, if I could say so, it raises the question of who's going to lead the country again. And a lot of political tension is happening around some protests every day, but not very, which is surprising for me. Protests are very big, but they are not as big as the revolution was. First night, there was just thousands of people on the street again, just saying that there is no other choice. The leader, Nikol Pashinyan, should go, and which, you know, not in a very nice way, but now rather more civilized protests, and some even, I mean, the process is going more towards healing and more towards looking forward and see what should be done and what should be done for country to get better.
So are you, I guess the question is at this point, are you expecting the young democracy to remain democratic? Or do you think that's the kind of issue that can topple over Armenia's democratic process?
It depends very much how we act. I mean, if we keep it, it will stay there. I mean, we have all the chances to keep the democracy in terms of having, for example, snap elections, not just doing another revolution, having more, you know, peaceful change of the government. But my belief at this point is there is no way that ruling party will stay in force for a long time. This is my just feeling and my choice, I'd say.
But so the president was elected in 2018, correct?
And we are not presidential democracy.
I'm sorry. Oh, okay. Like, sorry. What I don't know the exact electoral system, but the government was put in place through election 2 years ago.
Yes.
And I'm guessing the mandate is more than 2 years. So in theory, it could stay in place for another few years, right?
Mm-hmm, for another 3 years,
right?
Two and a half years, yeah.
Okay, so it's a 5-year term. So, do you vote for the prime minister, or is it parliamentary? Or
we are parliamentary. Yeah, our government is parliamentary, so we are voting for parliament, and then they are choosing the prime minister. We do have a president, but president is kind of not elected.
Right, and less of an important. Yeah, it's one of the countries where the president is not the actual.
Surprisingly, so yeah.
But yeah. There are a few of those. Yeah, but so do you think now the parliament is going to ask for the resignation of the prime minister and the government, or are they saying they're going to call for more elections or for new elections, or are they saying no, we're going to finish our term, or what's the situation there?
Well, it's really mixed up. I mean, we had a lot of ministers resigning recently, I believe. I mean, I lost the count. This is how many ministers are resigning right now, which is not funny, but it's kind of sounds fun. My guess is chosen government is trying to regain the power and trust, but the situation isn't. I mean, it's just mixed up. It's not crystallized yet to say what's gonna happen. It's just it's in the process. Depends a lot on how people will be acting. I mean, people saying. I mean, allied. Political elite people, and depending how they react to the different situations. Some people just think that agreement should be changed. Some people think that we just should heal and go back and gain the territories back. I mean, there are a lot of disputed.
Okay, but so just to be clear, the prime minister, which I guess is the one who holds the keys to the government, hasn't announced they're going to resign and call for new elections.
No, he's as far as I get, his intention is to stay.
Okay. All right. So how do you see things evolving? I guess that's going to be my last topic. How do you see things evolving for the country and at the same time for, I don't want to say the region, but I guess, you know, the relations with Azerbaijan and Turkey and the overarching influence of Russia? Like, how do you think things are going to evolve over the next few years?
Surprisingly, I'm very positive about how this can turn for Armenia. I mean, it can be a single case to reunite all the people and, like, you know, give kind of cold shower and be a call for focusing on the right thing, focusing, for example, on science, focusing on having more stable industries and, motivation and investments as the war should be more. I mean, if we look at it from investments and you look at the risk of war happening all the time, basically having the war situation out of the table for at least 5 years could give Armenia some opportunity for the growth, for faster growth in that time period. Basically, I'm very impatient to see how the political situation will stabilize back, and we will know for sure that for upcoming, I don't know, couple of years, this is the government that everybody agrees with, and no protests happening, because, you know, protests on the streets are a lot about government not working right. I mean, every time this happens, you know that people disagree to the extent of getting out to the street. So my expectation is to get that thing stabilized in a couple of months, I'd guess, and then focusing on getting more and more powerful in terms of science and in terms of education.
And so you think, you think it's going to be stabilized. That's a really important aspect. But why do you focus so much about science and education? Is that a prime concern in Armenia, or is that maybe what you're into and something that's been lacking? Like, why is it such
an interesting question. Focus? I mean that's the focus because the forces in this war were very unequal. Armenia being just 3 million people and Azerbaijan back to Turkey being like 10 million Azerbaijan and 10 a lot, and having the oil industry to back the industry. Armenia didn't have much of the force to, in both political sense, diplomacy sense, in sense of diplomatic relations, and in sense of military. But what I think why science and education should be refostered again is to become powerful. I mean, to be able to make our voice listened again, because this is just not going to happen that we are cared for just for our beautiful eyes. That's the vision, and a lot of people around me are sharing this. I mean, we need to have either the financial power or the military power to have the voice. And
science and education is a way to get more political strength, I guess. And since you don't have oil and you don't have the backing of Turkey and you don't, that's what you're saying. You have to science your way into more regional influence or more regional power. Is that what you mean?
Yes, to be able, yes. Exactly, your wording it way better than I do. Okay. And basically, yes, that's what I say.
I see. Okay. All right. Well, let's hope that happens and things are stable. Is there anything I didn't ask about or anything else you would like to add before we close the show?
No, I guess that's it. And I'm really, really thankful for raising the question. I'm not, again, sure that I was the best person to cover the topic, but I do hope I did give some perspective on what's happening on this side of the world.
You know, it's funny. It's every time I ask someone if they're interested in being on the show, they're always assuming that they are not someone that can speak to these things when, you know, we have so many journalists and people who do a certain kind of job that, again, is very important. But what we don't get is the opinion of the actual normal people who are going to tell us how they feel and how they see things. So, you know, and I think you did so very eloquently and very well. So thank you for taking the time. Before we leave, do you have an online presence in case people are interested in, you know, reaching out or just interested in seeing what you do? I believe you have a Twitter account.
Yes, I do have a Twitter account. Should I share that with you in the chat?
Yeah. Well, you can just say it now and I'll include it in the show notes. It is, I can say it, but go ahead. You're better at it than me.
Okay, so that will be Twitter account, and I'm presenting there at Ach Petrosyan, spelled as ACH. I guess I'll be the only ACH on the Twitter.
I'm sure. And I'll include it in the show notes. So Ach Petrosyan in the show notes. Anything else? Anything else you want to share?
No, I just would like to thank Julian, who was very supportive, and he gave me the idea that maybe I will be able to participate and share some thoughts.
Well, yeah, thanks. Thanks to both of you then. Thank you very much. As you know, my name is Patrick Beja. I am Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and everywhere else. If you appreciate the show, you can support it at patreon.com/thePhileas Club. The link is also in the show notes, and I appreciate every person who chooses to support the show financially. We are going to have episodes in December as well. But I would like to say for the record that it is look. I shouldn't jinx it. It is looking like 2021 isn't going to be so bad. We recently heard that the democratic process is moving forward in the US, which, as I mentioned, I think influences a large part of the world. Vaccines are being announced as potentially working left and right. And even Ach is optimistic about the future of Armenia after a pretty horrible few weeks. So listen, if you are optimistic, I think we don't have the right not to be as well, Ach. So thank you for telling us so on the show. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We will be back in a few weeks with another episode. Have a lovely day. Take care of each other, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders that we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.